I like these kind of days, especially because it's Thursday, and Thursday is my Friday, which is means my weekend starts at 6 o'clock this evening. But I like these kind of days on Issues Etc. when we have guests, well, we've got people to talk to the entire time. There's nothing wrong with open lines. I like it. We've done enough of it this week, probably. But you know, this is the bread and butter of a program like this. The strength of Issues Etc., as I've often said, is in its stable, in its galaxy of guests. And we've got some very good ones for you today on Issues Etc. In the first hour, we're going to be talking about politics, the gubernatorial race in California. There's something to talk about. The Democratic candidates for president, there are 9 of them. And the Bush presidency, our guest, Dr. Jeff Walz, will join us here in just a moment to kick off that conversation for the first hour of Issues Etc. He's associate professor of political science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. Pastor Matt Harrison joins us for the second hour of the program. Why do bad things happen? The book was Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? We might have to approach the question that way in the second hour, but why do bad things happen? Pastor Matt Harrison has seen his share of bad things. He is executive director of LCMS World Relief and Human Care. That's the second hour of the program. In the third hour, two guests, two great guests. Not that the others aren't good, but these guys, Mike Horton will be joining us in the third hour. It's very difficult to get him, and we've got him to talk about postmodernism and pop culture. He's co-host of the national radio program called The White Horse Inn. And in reading his latest in Modern Reformation magazine called Pop Goes Postmodernism, I was struck again why I like reading Mike Horton so much. The guy is simply brilliant. You'll get to bask in a bit of his brilliance there in the third hour of Issues Etc., at least during the first half. And then to round off today's program, the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for August, Craig Barton. The book is called The Defense Never Rests. We'll talk about law, evidence, and the defense of the Christian faith with Craig Barton in the last half hour of Issues Etc. today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to join us as we talk politics and political science in the first hour of Issues Etc. Our guest, Dr. Jeff Walz, is associate professor of political science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. Dr. Walz, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd. Good to be back.
Let's start by talking about, well, the biggest political story now that we're in legislative recess and the president is in Crawford. The biggest political story probably is the gubernatorial race in California. Just today, it was announced that there is a slate of candidates. It's over 150 of them for governor. Tell us this story. Bring us up to date on the gubernatorial race in California.
Okay, yes. Fascinating situation. We could have the first U.S. governor to be recalled in 82 years from California. And I think the issue talks and speaks much about democracy, and I guess, frankly, in some ways, to my mind at least, democracy run amok. We've got a situation here where California, of course, is in a tremendous fiscal strait, great unrest among the electorate. And there has been a movement to oust Gray Davis and to perhaps put someone in his place, and that's what will happen in October with the recall election. And as you said, today we do have more than 100 names of individuals of various types and sorts who have been certified to run in that race.
Now, I misspoke before. It's over 130, 135 to be exact. There were 247 people who put their names in. 111 of them did not qualify, either because they didn't pay their filing fee or because they didn't get the necessary 65 signatures. Why is Gray Davis being recalled?
Frustration primarily. Again, California's budget deficit is in the billions, $38 billion. The economy there, like in much of the country, has been suffering. There's a sense that Davis has not been trying to be proactive enough in addressing these issues, and I think it's really a sense that somebody has to be culpable. There has to be some kind of a scapegoat for the state's fiscal woes, and he's been the lightning rod. Also, he survived a very close election recently against Simon, so that certainly he doesn't have a mandate from that election.
Is California unique among the 50 states in providing for a recall of its governor if necessary?
It's not unique, but what I find interesting about California is it tends to set, as you know, tends to set trends where we had a tax revolt in California back in the late 70s, and that moved eastward across the country. We'll notice in Wisconsin here where I live, there have been recalls of elected officials. We do have a recall technique as well, or a recall situation here where we could recall our governor. Now, that there's been a little talk about that because of another issue here, but that mechanism is in place in other states. That's correct.
Now, you said, you at least said in passing, their democracy run amok when President Bush was asked down in Crawford, Texas, what he thought about the race in California. He says it's a fascinating bit of political drama. What do you mean by democracy run amok?
Well, I guess on the one hand, of course, we're premised upon the people governing, the people having the ability to determine who will lead them politically, and certainly I'm not opposed to that. But on the other hand, it seems that once we elect someone, unless that person commits a heinous crime or commits a felony or commits something legally that would question his or her leadership, I just don't know if it's a good idea to have a mechanism in place and to use a mechanism that in some cases might prematurely recall or oust someone from politics. It's kind of like if you get a job, I think one analogy might be, and you make a mistake, we all make mistakes, and all of a sudden you get your pink slip. So I guess there is, to my mind, a natural recall mechanism, which is the next election cycle. And I guess my concern is if the recall is used more often, and I've seen that here in Wisconsin, that politicians will be looking over their shoulders on every decision. Now again, yes, politicians should listen to their constituents, but in some cases as well, I think politicians need to make a decision that will go against their constituents. And certainly if the people don't like that decision, then come next election, they'll have a chance to make that statement. So it just seems to my mind that we should give these elected officials time to do their job, and then at the end of that term, evaluate that person for whether we want him or her to continue.
In other words, you're saying that the fact that we elect our officials to terms, whatever those terms may be, is in effect kind of the built-in recall, as you said.
Yes, exactly. Built-in type of recall. Exactly.
Now, let's see here. It seems as though someone from every party, almost every party, is running. We've got 50 Democrats, 42 Republicans, 32 Independents, 4 Green Party members, 3 Libertarian Party members, 2 from the Natural Law Party, and then 1 from the American Independent Party and 1 from the Peace and Freedom Party. It's not a foregone conclusion, however, here, because isn't Gray Davis, doesn't he have to actually be ousted by a majority vote before any of these guys really are a viable candidate for governor?
Correct. Yeah, correct. The voters, as you say, Todd, will have 2 decisions, whether first off to oust Gray Davis, and as you may have seen in some of the polls, at this point, and it's early, anywhere between 59% and 60% would vote affirmatively to recall, or in essence to oust him as governor. Then the second part of the ballot is whom would you like to replace him, assuming, of course, that there are enough votes to recall him. So yeah, it is a 2-step process in essence, although the voters will be making both decisions on the same ballot. So, yeah, exactly. It's not a foregone conclusion. You may, or some of our listeners may have heard that Gray Davis has reached down and he's talking with Bill Clinton on a fairly regular basis, President Clinton, for political advice. And while we, have, of course, may not necessarily like everything Clinton did politically and personally, clearly Clinton showed certain survivalist instincts, and if he can translate those into Gray Davis, certainly Davis could survive this vote as well.
That is always a possibility. Now, let's say for the sake of argument that he does not survive the recall vote. He is recalled, and in the same ballot, here are 135 candidates in a very peculiar order, which we'll talk about here in a minute.
Yes.
Is it necessary for anyone on that ballot to get a majority in order to become governor?
No, it's not. No, just a plurality. In other words, the most votes.
That could make for some very strange politics.
Yes, very strange politics indeed. So we, you know, potentially could have the winner with, you know, 10% of the vote, or 15 or 20 or even 9% of the vote. So, and clearly that person would not have a mandate from the voters either, even though we've seen some data suggest that perhaps up to 3/4 of California voters, at least at this point, say they intend to vote in that recall election.
Is the citizenry in California essentially saying, if they oust Gray Davis and whoever they elect, are they essentially saying, we don't care anybody but Davis?
Yes, anybody but Davis. And I think a very fascinating part of this, too, initially the Democrat, at least the prominent Democrats, had decided to stay out of it. Now the lieutenant governor in California, he is one of these final candidates, Democratic candidates. So his perspective or his argument is, you know, don't oust Gray Davis, my fellow Democrat, but if as a populist or if as a constituency you decide to do that, then definitely vote me in as a fellow Democrat or someone who might carry on that Democratic banner. So it is a kind of, you could say, schizophrenic kind of argument, but it, in a sense, it makes some logic and makes some sense.
You're talking about, of course, Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante.
Yes.
And how would you assess his chances of pulling that very scenario off? Davis gets ousted and the people say, hey, let's just stay with the people we elected the last time around, Cruz Bustamante.
At this point, probably not good, just because the lieutenant governor does carry that Democratic Davis baggage with him. Kind of depends, as we all know, Arnold Schwarzenegger is the front runner, at least at this point. But if Schwarzenegger were to falter and come back to the pack, it is conceivable that Lieutenant Governor would be the one remaining viable candidate to a lot of folks.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, he's on the cover of Time magazine, several other weekly magazines as well. He's in the paper virtually every day across the nation and on television. Now, he would probably be making some of those magazines and those television appearances and those newspaper headlines because he's got a major motion picture out that's still raking into the box office.
Yes.
Is the timing here uncanny?
It is uncanny, and in a sense it's uncanny, but on the other hand, I think it could jeopardize his potential or his prospects as well, because it seems to me, at least right now in California, that people like the image of Schwarzenegger. They like him in the movies. They like this persona, this Hollywood persona. But what could hurt him is overexposure, where people see too much of him, and especially if he would begin to perhaps articulate his political agenda, which, at least from what we can tell at this point, is not what one might call a hard bedrock Republican platform. So I think for him, yeah, the exposure helps at this point, but at least in the short run or short term, the more he keeps his mouth shut, I think the better his prospects are, especially given we're, you know, what, 60 days or less than 60 days out.
Now, assess what we know of the front runner's political leanings on the big issues, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Where would you put him on the political spectrum?
Yeah, he's more of what we call a fiscal conservative and a social liberal overall. So in other words, from a Republican perspective, he's, for the most part, pretty good on the tax issues from what he's said. And again, he hasn't said much. And also, you may recall Proposition 187, which was a proposal passed by California voters several years ago that denied certain benefits for illegal aliens. And in many of the more conservative enclaves of Republicanism in California, that was the proper vote. But it could be problematic because many commentators say that in many ways, with the Latino and the Hispanic population, put them at arm's length and really tended to lose support from that population. So on those issues, tax issues and fiscal issues, he tends to be more in line with the Republican Party, whereas social issues, again, he hasn't said much, but he appears to be, for example, pro-choice on abortion, which, again, could help him with some of the moderate voters, but not endear him to more of the hardcore Christian conservatives.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Waltz, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin. We're talking about some political issues, political landscape, still dealing with the gubernatorial race in California. If you've got a question or a comment, we will be moving on to the Democratic presidential candidates, and we'll be talking about the Bush presidency with less, well, let's see, how are we going here? We're talking about just a little over a year and a half, maybe a year and a half, until President Bush finishes his first term. We'll find out what you think about it as well. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. All right, we've mentioned Cruz, Bustamante, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Bill Simon lost against Gray Davis last time, and yet he's also in the race. There's Larry Flynt, there's Gary Coleman from Different Strokes, mm-hmm. There's Arianna Huffington, and Peter Uberoth, who's the former baseball commissioner. What are the chances of any of these others, apart from either Bustamante or Schwarzenegger?
Probably quite low at this point. They do have, as you said, Todd, they do have some name recognition, but because there are so many of them, it's going to be difficult for one of those more high-profile personalities to garner enough votes to win. So they're almost going to cancel each other out in a sense. Again, Simon, as you said, lost in the last election, and a lot of people thought he might be the heir apparent without Schwarzenegger. Although, had Schwarzenegger not entered the race, I think it still really would have been a toss-up. So, yeah, the odds of these other candidates, not very good at this point.
Explain to us this odd ordering. I mean, not only do we have 135 candidates on the ballot being printed as we speak in California, but the ordering is not going to be alphabetical or even random. What is it?
Yeah. What happened? Of course, we have the 26 letters in the alphabet, and what happened is there was a drawing with those letters so that we would line them up, not alphabetically, but as they were drawn, according to just a random draw. So what this did, it was an attempt at least to try and level the playing field so that someone with a last name with an A, for example, would not be at the top of the ballot across the board, which is how it's done normally. And what happened as well, instead of going with the preordained order, which if I recall, I think R might be the first letter. I'd have to check that. But
RWQ is the first letter.
RWQ, okay. Mm-hmm. So what they're going to do is in 86 different districts, they're going to also alter the order so that if R was first in District 1, for example, in District 2, it would be last. And they'll just kind of go in order and rotate where the last letter, those names, become first in the next district, and then they slide down to second and so on. So it's really an attempt, again, to try and not give an advantage to people with names, especially at the front or the back of the alphabet. So, that's talk about fascinating. That's another fascinating part of this as well.
Well, when I first heard this, I thought, this sounds like something that is just ready-made for a repeat of what happened in 2002 with the presidential elections in Florida, a court challenge to these things. And then I discovered that California has had this procedure, this randomized alphabet procedure, in place for all of its elections since 1975.
I didn't know that. Interesting. And what is possible here, though, that troubles some people is there's not a uniform methodology of ballot counting across the state. And we saw that, of course, in Florida. a few years back. So, of course, we're much better than we were then, but that's another potential problem when you think about how we're going to count the votes.
Okay. There have been, just in the last several days, allegations from the Democratic National Committee, I believe, that the White House was somehow involved in this recall election, somehow behind the whole push for the recall election of Gray Davis in California. What do you know? How likely is this?
I don't know much about it, Todd. It seems unlikely because you can really look at this from a political perspective vis-a-vis the White House. You know, a lot of people are saying, well, this is a great thing. You know, Bush can have maybe, you know, Schwarzenegger, a fellow Republican in California in the governor's office, and this might help Bush or at least force the Democrats to pay more attention to the state in 2004 rather than put sources elsewhere. That's a possibility, although on the other hand, too, if you have a Gray Davis still there who's weakened, who's vulnerable, whom Democrats and certainly Republicans are not rallying around, I think that could have been, or still could be, just as advantageous to the Republicans as having their own Republican in the high office. Because, you know, obviously just because Schwarzenegger or whomever Republican becomes governor potentially doesn't mean the economy is going to suddenly improve and the budget deficit will suddenly go away. So there certainly are perils from that political perspective, from a Republican viewpoint, of having a Republican in the governor's spot.
Is there any advantage to having an R behind the name of a governor in a state when it comes to the presidential election?
Yeah, there certainly could be. Although, again, what the Bush White House is trying to do, because it's unlikely, at least still at this point, things can change, but generally, California has been fairly solidly Democratic in the White House, of course, with exceptions. But if you look back in 2000, that was easily a Gore victory. So what the Bush people want to do is again, to force the Democrats to defend California at the congressional level, at the Senate level, at the White House level, and so put resources there that could not then be used elsewhere. So I don't know if having an R behind the governor's name is as important as trying to defend that turf.
Apparently, Karl Rove has been arguing recently as 3 weeks ago, according to CNN, that really it's to Bush's advantage in 2004 if Davis were still in office in California, because it gives him someone and a party to run against out there.
Yeah, that's the other side of it. And if the Republicans are really serious about winning California, you know, it's a lot easier to take pot shots at the administration in office who is not performing well or is not tending to the economy well than it is, to defend your own administration. So, yeah, that certainly is a viable perspective.
When we come back from this break, I received an email from a listener in Los Angeles just last night, and he was pointing out a few things about how significant it is, beyond the politics, how significant it is who is governor, and this recall election in California is for the rest of the nation. A few economic facts, we'll bounce them off our guest, Dr. Jeff Walls, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, when we come back from this break. Feel free to join us. We've got open phone lines for your questions and your comments on the subject of California's race, on the subject of the Democratic candidates for president, or anything political. We'll be rounding off our conversation with Jeff Walls, talking about the Bush presidency about a year and a half out from the end of his first term. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What is the proper role of Christian apologetics? Is Christian apologetics even necessary? Is there a popular confusion of apologetics and evangelism? What is the proper role of reason and logic in the Christian faith? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August is called The Defense Never Rests, A Lawyer's Quest for the Gospel by Craig Parton.
You can order The Defense Never Rests by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can order The Defense Never Rests online at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section, and you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, The Defense Never Rests by Craig Parton, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on people who fear the evil eye. They're Bedouins living in Egypt. For centuries, Bedouins have lived their nomadic lifestyle in temporary shelters while they followed their livestock. Today, computers, TVs, and tourism have completely changed their lives. The Mission Agency Operation Mobilization points out that only a small number of Egypt's 1.4 million Bedouins have heard about Jesus Christ. But some Christians care deeply about the Bedouins and are learning the tribal culture in order to share Christ. Missionaries with Operation Mobilization have different options for serving that usually come from a deep passion and love for people. OM missionaries have a wide set of skills that can be used in missions. Pray for Bedouins to learn about Christ's love. Learn how to use your skills in missions by visiting the website usa.om.org. That's usa.om.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Daryl Pennell is a 41-year-old who lives under an overpass in Detroit. Thanks to Detroit Free Press writer Jim Schaefer for permission to quote from his interview. Pennell comes from a good family, but he says, "Somewheres down the line there, I missed something, man. Made me go sidetracking. For some reason, to this date, I'm still sidetracking, and I don't know how to snap out of it." "What do you do under the bridge?" reporter Schaefer asked. "I read books, and I think about a lot of stuff, man. I think about how my life's going, how I screwed up, how I can make it better. I think about how people tell me how I should be doing." "What would you say if someone told you to get a job?" "I wouldn't know how to answer that question. I would probably say, 'That's kind of rude, bro. You don't even know what I'm going through.'" Someone has said, "Don't tell me what a friend I have in Jesus until I see what a friend I have in you." Thanks for listening. I'm Dale Meyer.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like By the Way, our thought for the day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, it's the Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment. Features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., a two-hour discussion with Craig Parton. We're going to be talking about the nine, well, not there. I don't think we get through all nine of them. We get through most of them, though. The spiritual laws of crossless pietism. A very interesting conversation with Craig Parton tomorrow on the program. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm about to read an email from Andy in Los Angeles. If you've got a question or a comment to make about the political landscape in the United States today, be it the gubernatorial race in California, the Democratic candidates for president, President Bush and his presidency thus far, feel free to give us a call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Jeff Waltz is our guest. Dr. Waltz, Andy writes this from California. "California is the fifth largest economy in the world, surpassing France, China, and other major countries." And this is according to a commerce report from the state of California. He says, "California's economy accounts for 1/7 of the total U.S. economy, and I think that the state should not be underestimated in terms of its effect on the rest of the nation economically. And he says that's a reason to watch this gubernatorial race in California. What do you think?
Definitely, Todd. The statistics underlie clearly the fiscal power of California. We should certainly watch it for that reason. I'm a little more interested, though, as well, in exactly how California, the legislators, and the governor try and deal with this budget deficit. Because, as you said, it is such a huge economy. It employs so many people at both the private and the public sector that how it deals with its problems, aside from the recall, I think will be at least a signal, or will be certainly quite a harbinger, perhaps, of how other states are dealing with these issues as well. So, yeah, it certainly is an economic powerhouse.
It's hard to conceive of this being in living, at least at this time, in a state where it kind of falls in the middle of the ground economically in the United States and elsewhere. How significant California is by way of population in the United States and economy, both in the United States and outside. It's a huge state.
It is. It's got more people than Canada. It's got tremendous technological prowess, and this huge budget deficit, in large part, there are, of course, a lot of factors, but when the technological bubble burst and a lot of those stock plans went south, that really took a lot of the impetus and, frankly, a lot of the cash out of that financial situation. So certainly something to watch.
Andy's on the line from Los Angeles. Andy, thanks for the email earlier, and thanks for giving us a call. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make the comment with this election, it's kind of interesting because one of the key things about it being different is that we're having it because of this strong grassroots effort by many people that were paid and unpaid to even have it. And so I'm sort of curious. I wonder if even the sort of standard political calculus of, we need to have somebody in the center in order to have a winner, you know, for example, Arnold Schwarzenegger, whether that will even hold, because I think there are a lot of people out there that have quite strong feelings about the economy, and if they feel like Schwarzenegger or someone else really can't tackle that, they might be willing to go for somebody that, you know, in a standard election they wouldn't go for.
Andy, thank you, and thanks for listening out there on the West Coast. Your reaction?
Yeah, excellent comment, Andy. Especially, I'm inspired by, as you said, and I wasn't aware of this, the nature of course, the unpaid kind of enthusiasm and participation by a number of people, regardless of the candidate whom they're supporting. You know, as you heard earlier in the show, I'm not exactly a fan of the recall. Because a lot of times these are engineered with folks who are out there, you know, paid for so many signatures. But if it's, you know, more of a truly grassroots effort, while probably philosophically I'm still not enamored with it, it's great to see that kind of involvement from the grassroots in government to try and make the system better. So that certainly heartens me.
The other major phenomenon that is on the political landscape nowadays is this giant slate of Democratic candidates for president. There are 9 of them. Who's the front runner, in your opinion? Let's deal with that one first.
It seems to me you've got 3 candidates who could be considered front runners. Certainly John Kerry, certainly Joe Lieberman. And while he may not be a front runner, he's certainly making inroads, Howard Dean, the governor of Vermont. And what's so fascinating here, as you said, Todd, this huge field, you know, if the Democratic Party could wave a magic wand, it would want one candidate to appear or to come out of the primaries and caucuses that will start early next year as soon as possible, because we all know the more divisive a primary or a caucus season, in other words, the more competition, the more carping candidate on candidate, the longer this drags out, what you tend to have then in the fall, it's harder to rally the party around one candidate. And so that's where the Republicans have always been so good generally about having one candidate emerge somewhat soon in the process, although, of course, there have been exceptions. So the Democrats are looking for a front runner right now, but I think you really have those 3 main candidates who are jostling at the top.
What became of Congressman Dick Gephardt? He just last week got a rather sizable endorsement from a sector of the labor union.
Yes, and certainly I don't mean to downplay Gephardt as well. He is a player. My sense from afar is that, you know, there's this, as you know, this battle within each party, and the Democrats are battling now for, quote-unquote, you know, the heart and soul of the party. You know, do we want to go the way of Bill Clinton's, kind of the centrist Democratic vision, or do we want to go the way of more of a purist or more of a grassroots Democratic vision? Kind of the reason, for example, that a Howard Dean might be in the race, because he feels, for example, that the Democratic Party has lost its way on a number of key issues like the war in Iraq. So there's that battle within the party, and I think Gephardt, you know, he's kind of straddling the fence. He wants to be this kind of centrist Democrat, but in some quarters he's perceived as more of the left-wing Democrat. You know, the health care plan, the Teamsters endorsement, and kind of the old Democratic coalition. So he's certainly a player. I think he needs to, you know, reposition himself a bit, so that he is more of a viable centrist candidate, if that's the way the party wants to go.
How do you explain the somewhat unexpected popularity and attention that Governor Howard Dean is receiving lately?
Yeah, that is fascinating. Actually, a friend, a colleague of mine, went to one of his kind of cottage meetings here about a week ago, and everyone got some literature on how to be involved, on how to write letters to two other people, how to kind of get this grassroots movement off the ground. And I think he's really energized that left wing of the Democratic Party, the more anti-war wing, the more critical of capitalism wing to a point, the wing that believes more strongly in government. Because, you know, with Clinton, you know, a lot of Democrats say Clinton sold the party out, and this is the problem Gore engaged or had to deal with too in the year 2000. So I think he's really struck a chord with those purists. And, you know, I've heard some Democrats say, for example, well, look at 1964, where the Republicans appeared, at that point at least, to have no chance after LBJ's landslide victory. But rising out of those ashes, as it were, we had this whole kind of revolution, the Reagan Revolution. We had Nixon, of course, first. And so there's a feeling among some Democrats that in order to win back the White House, you need to get back to, you know, the Democratic first things and not sell out to this kind of centrist, moderate vision or version of the Democratic Party that to some looks more like a pseudo-Republican party.
And why is it that although these, at least the majority of these nine contenders for the presidential candidacy for the Democratic Party, have been making the rounds very faithfully, going every place they need to be, Iowa, they're in New Hampshire, they're even, some of them are hitting, you know, some of the primary caucuses prospects farther down the line, they're debating one another, why are they getting so little attention?
In part because of other, you know, other issues in the world, the Iraq war, the California situation that we talked about, but also, you know, the more candidates you have, the more difficult it is to really have a qualitative debate. And when you have 7, 8, 9 candidates, you know, if you recall that debate a while back, the first debate we had, I think it was back in April even perhaps, you know, you had such little time for response. You didn't have time for interaction. So I just think there's too much of the forest there, and we're not seeing the trees necessarily. I think a second issue too, and this might change in the next couple, 3 weeks, you've had some of these candidates like John Edwards of North Carolina, whom I didn't mention, who still could be a viable candidate, of course, trying to juggle different responsibilities. So I'd like to, and Lieberman too, for example, I'd like to run for president, but I'm also a senator. So if you don't see me at a certain event or a debate, you know, it's because I was serving the country in that capacity. So it's difficult to get, I think, a sense of continuity as well.
I think I feel compelled to point out that Congressman Dick Gephardt, who's the local boy here and running for president, has been criticized, at least locally here, for missing so many of his votes since he started running.
Yeah, exactly. Gephardt, I think, is a great public servant, and you know he's of course made the case, which probably is a good case, that he's been there for the key votes, and other votes he hasn't been there that he would consider less important. And you know we could probably philosophically debate, when you're a senator or representative, what is your first role, or what is your first dedication to? Is it to the Senate or to the House, or is it to running for this high office? And I can certainly understand those controversy and those concerns.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Waltz about the political landscape and things political today, talking about now the Democratic candidates for president. If you'd like to join us, feel free to do so, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Those are our call-in numbers. Well, beginning at the middle of January and running through practically the entire year in 2004, this series of primaries and caucuses will begin in Iowa, very closely followed by New Hampshire. Missouri will have its primary, I believe, very early in February of 2004. Mid-March, Illinois will have its primary as well. Explain this process to us.
I could give you actually a whole dissertation since I did this in grad school, but I won't bore you with that. It's really a way for the voters and for the party faithful in the states, in a series of states, to determine whom they prefer to be the party candidate or the party nominee, both for the Republicans and for the Democrats. Now, of course, on the Republican side, Bush, I would suspect, will have no opposition or very token and very minor opposition. So that's not really a contest. But on the Democratic side, the plan was to devise a series of contests so that the candidates could prove themselves to the voters in a more sequential, progressive kind of stage. So, you know, a classic example of an outsider, Jimmy Carter in 1976, when the peanut farmer governor from Georgia comes out of nowhere through these primaries, through these caucuses, the caucuses where the party faithful vote in meetings, primaries where you go and vote in a voting booth. It was through these contests that Carter proved himself and then emerged as the nominee, who, of course, eventually became president in 1976. And so it was meant as this kind of progressive learning process. But what it's become is more of this very front-loaded system where, instead of having a candidate emerge in May or June or even April, you know, we could have a candidate emerge, you mentioned February, in February, and probably, I would think, at the latest in March. So it's a very compacted, front-loaded, almost a national primary or caucus in some ways.
I have in-laws in Iowa, the first. It's scheduled for January 19th in 2004. It's their caucus. And they tell us during presidential election season, they actually get to meet the candidates. I mean, when you go to one of these meetings, those guys are there, and they are working the Iowans over in a major way. You can, if you want to go shake hands with every single one of them, you can.
Yeah, exactly. That's retail politics at its core, at its basic core. And frankly, if you love politics and if you think it's important and you live in Iowa or New Hampshire, the first two states, then it's just your heyday because, yeah, the candidates have to come. They have to appeal to you. They have to get to know you. The old joke goes that the citizen said, "I'm not going to vote for this candidate because I've only talked with him twice." This would just be unheard of for most of us. So in one sense, it's great for politics because instead of wholesale, in other words, instead of using TV, radio, these more distant media, in Iowa and New Hampshire, you can actually see these people up close and personal. Now, what that says for the people in the other 48 states is not as encouraging. So there have been efforts to revive or at least to revise the system so that other states would have at least a comparable kind of retail one-on-one personal experience with these candidates.
If you had to pick two of the nine right now, and I'll let you pick two rather than one so I don't put you on the spot, who will be facing Bush in 2004, what two would you pick?
I think I'd pick Lieberman and Kerry. And of those two, Lieberman, of course, who ran with Gore, seems to me, if he can get through this primary and caucus stage, we don't know, of course, what's down the road, but he, you know, he would be a viable candidate, I think, against Bush. Culturally, Lieberman has been critical, for example, of Hollywood. Lieberman has taken a fairly strongly, not pro-war necessarily, but he's been supportive of Bush in Iraq. So he, you know, has some of the distinctives and some of the presidential persona, I think, to give Bush a run for his money, and certainly Kerry could as well.
Will John Kerry's Vietnam War credentials, which if you go to his website, there's a regular flash in the thing of him standing with his buddies someplace in Vietnam in his uniform, will his Vietnam War credentials help him against Bush if he becomes the front runner?
Yeah, I think certainly they could help him. What might not help him now, and I know these are difficult issues and there are many shades of gray, but you may have seen where, you know, Lieberman called Kerry on the carpet for saying that Kerry wants to have it both ways. In other words, Kerry says in theory, yes, I've supported the Iraq operation, but in practice, I don't like exactly how some of the fundamentals and how some of these specific strategies were played out. So, yeah, I like the idea of the Iraq invasion, but I don't like, you know, some of how it was engineered or operated. And that, you know, that I think could give him some trouble down the road, because still most of America, even given the continuing difficulties and the deaths on an almost daily basis of servicemen, still support the president and still support our presence in Iraq, even as it's been certainly imperfect.
Well, yet, let's use that subject, if we could, to segue into the final element of our conversation here in the few minutes that are left, and that is the assessment of the Bush presidency. Let's start with the assessment of the war after the May announcement that formal hostilities were ended, the announcement that was, of course, made from the deck of an aircraft carrier, everyone's watching. How do you think the war is going for the president?
Frankly, I think it's going about as well as can be expected. I know we can second-guess certain aspects of the war. We can second-guess the after-war strategy and preparation, but most of the experts certainly would not and did not predict that there'd be some blossoming, burgeoning democratic state that would emerge after the main hostilities were over. So, you know, as far as these tragic deaths that continue to happen in this guerrilla type of atmosphere, in some ways they just cannot be helped, given the vastness of this country, given the uncertainty of the situation. And, you know, I think this is clearly is a 2, 3, 4, 5 year operation of some kind to try and get this country on a more democratic footing. So it seems to me not a perfect operation, of course, but done about as well as possible.
One of the things that concerns people the most, I have a relative who's actually in Iraq, and his wife and of course the whole family is concerned about the time for him to come home, especially since he's a reservist as well. Well, only now are they starting to hear rumblings that maybe they have a date, they have a plane date, but they don't know when that's going to be. There's a chance, they said, look, we can keep reservists 2 years legally if we want to. How likely do you think it is that George W. Bush facing the re-election challenge will allow servicemen to stay over there longer than people usually deem necessary? People are thinking 9 months, a year at the most, but not more than that.
Yeah, excellent question. It seems to me that election realities and just morale considerations in the forefront, that while the president may need to keep certain divisions longer, that he will bring them back to stateside, at least for some time, rather than certainly keeping them out there the whole 2 years. You know, and that's one of the issues that could, you know, we could criticize the administration for, is we didn't realize the human power that it would take to actually try and implement a peaceful kind of resolution to the democratic state or a possible democratic state of Iraq. And, you know, we only have so many divisions. We have other responsibilities worldwide. But even given that, I think that the president will bring back divisions as he can and not, if at all possible, not stretch it out to those two-year limits.
Dr. Waltz, would you be willing to stick with us for a few minutes after this break to wrap up a few loose strings in our conversation about the Bush presidency?
Yes, sure.
All right, thank you. One more thing before we go to that break. The other thing that I think is probably the biggest question mark for people going into 2004 in a presidential election is the state of the economy. How do you think that's going for the president at present?
Not well. You know, we want to say the president is not responsible for the economy, and certainly there are so many other factors that the president has, it's true, has very little control over it, but we're pocketbook voters. We do hold someone or want to hold someone responsible for the economy, and that, of course, happens to be the president. So, you know, I know the unemployment figure has kind of held steady and even gotten slightly better, but, you know, there are others out there who don't show up in those statistics. There are people who are underemployed, others who are certainly working in positions that are less than desirable. So while the productivity numbers, you know, might give us some hope, there's that underlying, that kind of underbelly of dissatisfaction on the job front. And I think that's what the president needs to be most concerned about. Now, what he can do about that, probably, frankly, is very little. We know he passed this tax cut proposal, and that's supposed to be the engine behind some of this renewal. And I guess we'll have to see how well that works.
We'll take this up on the other side of the break. Our guest, Dr. Jeff Waltz, he's associate professor of political science at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, talking about politics in this hour of Issues Etc. A few more minutes with Dr. Waltz when we come back. If you've got a question or a comment, the break is a great time to call 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If you need something that's going on in the political world explained to you, or if you've just simply got an opinion to air on the issues we've been discussing or something else that we haven't covered, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'd love to hear from internet callers across the country. Andy called earlier from California, chiming in on the gubernatorial race there. I'd like to get the pulse of your state. Give us a call. That toll-free number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, we've talked about the war. I want to do a few more items on the economy, if we could, vis-a-vis the Bush presidency. And then we need to talk about a running mate for the president. It's not altogether sure that Dick Cheney is going to be back in the second position in a Bush second term. Who else could it be? Colin Powell is leaving. He ain't coming back. Who's going to take his place? Those are big questions. If you have questions or comments, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll also talk about other matters political as you raise the questions. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.